Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to IJ's live call reviewing the recently completed Supreme Court term. We'll be talking about IJ's cases before the court, as well as other noteworthy decisions that came down over the last few months. I'm Melanie Hildreth. I'm pleased to be here with IJ President and General Counsel Scott Bullock, who will be hosting our conversation. We're joined by IJ Attorney Sam Gedge, IJ Senior Attorney Michael Bindis, and IJ Senior Vice President and Litigation Director Dana Berliner. Thank you all for joining us.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Melanie. As all the listeners know, this was an incredibly active year for the Institute for Justice at the Supreme Court. In February of this year, we got the very good news that the Supreme Court ruled unanimously in our favor in the historic Timms v. Indiana case involving excessive fines and civil forfeiture. In June, the Supreme Court also ruled in our client's favor and IJ's favor in a case coming out of Tennessee challenging durational residency requirements for the sale of wine and spirits. And then on the very last day of the Supreme Court's term, we got the very good news that the court is going to hear our educational choice case out of Montana that's going to put the Blaine Amendment issue squarely before the court. We're actually in the process right now of drafting the briefs in that case. We're going to be talking about that case a little bit during the course of this call and also be the subject of a future live call that we do. And that case will be argued next term at the Supreme Court. And as Melanie mentioned, we also want to talk about some other cases that IJ wasn't directly involved in, but also impact the fight for individual liberty. So let's talk first about the decision in Timms. We had done an earlier call about the Timms case, but there's been some developments, of course, since the decision's been handed down. And I'd like to turn to Sam Gedge, who was the co-lead counsel in the Timms case, and just talk a little bit for the callers, Sam, and remind folks what Timms involved.
Sure. So Tyson Timms's case involved an issue that for anybody who's ever really thought about it, most people would assume it was decided a long time ago, namely whether the Eighth Amendment's ban on excessive fines applies to the federal government alone or whether it also stops states and municipalities from imposing excessive fines as well. Now, the Indiana Supreme Court said that until the U.S. Supreme Court tells us otherwise, we're going to assume that there's no limit on state excessive fines. And we're happy to report that the U.S. Supreme Court has now said otherwise and has incorporated this really critical protection in the Bill of Rights against states and municipalities.
All right. So in one of the great aspects about this decision that I think a lot of people were inspired by was the fact that it was unanimous. All of the justices reached the conclusion that the excessiveness clause of the Eighth Amendment means something and it should be enforced against state and local governments. Well, as we all know at around this table, and I'm sure all the listeners, that when the Supreme Court speaks or any court does, governments just immediately roll over and abide by whatever the Supreme Court says. Is that what usually happens?
Well, this time it did not happen.
Right. I think there's been a few other times where that has not happened before.
So the U.S. Supreme Court, of course, made this important sweeping ruling that the excessive fines clause applies to the states. And the state of Indiana immediately turned around and said, well, maybe it does, but we're certainly not going to concede that this particular forfeiture in this particular case is excessive. And the background of Tyson's case, of course, is that he was arrested for a low-level drug crime, was convicted, you know, paid his debt to society, as they say, and the state of Indiana is still trying to take his $42,000 car. So what we're doing now is we're continuing the fight on Tyson's behalf. We're back in front of the Indiana Supreme Court, and we're arguing that we now know the excessive fines clause applies here, and it's been violated by taking Tyson's car.
And that's typical what the Supreme Court in particular does, is they kind of set a broad rule, and then it's up to the lower courts to kind of decide, well, what does excessiveness really mean? And we are, of course, have a great interest in doing that in our forfeiture work, in our fines and fees work. We're going to make sure that that the Indiana Supreme Court does the right thing and interprets this in a way that's the most protective of property owners. And you just argued the case before the court last month.
That's right. We had the argument at the Indiana Supreme Court at the end of June, and we are waiting on their decision.
Great. Well, stay tuned for that. The Indiana Solicitor General got beat up at the U.S. Supreme Court. He also got beat up pretty good at the Indiana Supreme Court. So hopefully the court will do the right thing, and we'll make sure that we stay on them to ensure that they do. Great. Well, let's turn to Michael Bindis and talk a little bit about the case out of Tennessee involving Tennessee's durational residency requirements. We'll talk a little bit about what that actually means to remind people what was happening there and what the government was doing. But if you could just talk a little bit, Michael, about how we heard about this case and how IJ got involved.
Sure. This concept of durational residency requirements is one I've been interested in for quite some time. These are laws that require you to be a resident of a state for a certain period of time before you can engage in a business or an occupation. They're particularly nefarious because they inhibit the ability of Americans to migrate from state to state in pursuit of a livelihood. And in fact, Tennessee had one of these requirements for retail liquor licenses. In order to secure a license to open a retail liquor shop in Tennessee, you had to be a resident of the state for 2 years. At that point, you could get a license. The license was only good for 1 year, however, and then to renew it, you had to be a resident of the state for 10 years. So you could get a license after 2 years, operate a shop for 1 year. Then, in effect, you had to close down for the next 7 years until you hit that 10-year point, and at that point, you could open up again. If that sounds crazy, it was, and the reason it was crazy was for a very real purpose, and that was the law was designed to protect the established in-state liquor businesses from new competition. Fortunately, the state was not enforcing this law for a period. The Tennessee Attorney General recognized that it was unconstitutional, but that changed in 2016 when two new license applications were submitted, one by the national chain retailer Total Wine, the other by the couple that would go on to become IJ's clients in the case, Doug and Mary Ketchum, who were moving to Tennessee for the purpose of purchasing a small mom-and-pop liquor shop in Memphis. When those two license applications were submitted, the trade group that represents the established in-state liquor businesses threatened to sue the state if it issued the licenses. And at that point, the state itself went to court and filed a lawsuit asking the court to determine the constitutionality of the law. As the case was progressing, I came across it in my research on these durational residency issues. And when the time was right, I approached Doug and Mary about the possibility of IJ's taking over the case and litigating it on their behalf, and they were very eager to have us do that.
Right, and the party before the Supreme Court, we were representing Doug and Mary, this wonderful couple that just wanted to pursue a livelihood in a new state. But the state attorney general was nowhere to be found in the case. Is that right?
that's exactly right. It was bizarre. The state did not file a brief in the Supreme Court. The state attorney general did not argue in the Supreme Court. In fact, it was the private attorney for the liquor cartel that argued the state's position. And that was a fact that was not lost on the justices, who actually commented on the fact that the Tennessee attorney general was nowhere to be seen.
Yet rarely is economic protectionism so naked as the cartel actually doing the litigation.
Exactly. Here you have a law that was designed to protect existing businesses, and you have government handing over enforcement authority, in effect, to those very businesses the law was designed to protect.
And this really was. I mean, they tried to make some arguments about this is really about curtailing liquor consumption, but this was really a case, and ultimately the court ruled that this was really about economic protectionism.
That's exactly right. In the majority opinion by Justice Alito, he made very clear that economic protectionism is not a legitimate justification for regulating alcohol, and that when courts are faced with these types of challenges involving these types of laws, they really have to engage in a close scrutiny of the law and figure out, based on the evidence, a real look at the evidence, what the law is trying to accomplish and what its effect is. And if the predominant effect of the law is economic protectionism, it's unconstitutional. And the court had no trouble concluding that that's exactly what was going on with Tennessee's law.
And this was a case that also followed up on some of IJ's previous litigation involving the interstate shipment of wine. Could you talk just a little bit about that earlier case and how this case and decision impacts that?
Absolutely. So folks on the call may recall back in 2005, IJ had another Supreme Court victory in a case called Granholm. In that case, we represented Juanita Swedenberg, a winemaker in Virginia, in challenging a law, a New York law, that allowed in-state but not out-of-state wineries to ship directly to New York consumers. We challenged that law under the Commerce Clause, the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine, which is a doctrine that recognizes that states cannot discriminate against out-of-state economic interests. The state defended the law. They acknowledged, in effect, that the law would ordinarily violate the Commerce Clause, but they claimed that it was somehow saved by the 21st Amendment. The 21st Amendment is the constitutional amendment that repealed prohibition, and according to New York, it gave the state certain heightened regulatory powers that effectively insulated laws that might otherwise violate the Commerce Clause from any kind of meaningful scrutiny. The court rejected that argument, thankfully, which was great for Juanita and for IJ. But in the wake of that decision, states began interpreting Granholm very, very narrowly, as did some courts. They said, well, that case only concerned discrimination against out-of-state alcohol producers, namely wineries or breweries or distillers. It has nothing to say about states discriminating against other economic interests in the alcohol context, such as retailers. That's squarely the issue that the Tennessee case put in play, whether Granholm was that narrowly limited or whether the court meant what it actually said, which is, no, states may not discriminate against economic interests in the alcohol industry, period.
Right. And you had mentioned the decision was 7-2. It was a nice majority of the justices on our side. But there were two justices in dissent, and some of the listeners might be a little bit surprised to hear that Justices Thomas and Justice Gorsuch were the two dissenters in that case. So talk a little bit about majority opinion and why those two justices that oftentimes are, you know, they're not usually big fans of economic protectionism, why they ruled the way they did.
Sure. The majority took the position correctly that the Commerce Clause, number one, prohibits discrimination against all economic interests when it comes to alcohol, not just out-of-state alcohol producers. Moreover, Justice Alito, in that opinion, held that the 21st Amendment is not a blank check and it doesn't save a law that would otherwise violate the Commerce Clause. And then, of course, he went on to talk about economic protectionism and how that's not a legitimate justification for government regulation in this situation. The dissent, as you mentioned, was authored by Justice Gorsuch and joined by Justice Thomas. And I think their position really came down to two things. Number one was just a different reading of the history of the 21st Amendment and what it was meant to accomplish. Their take on that history, an incorrect one, I think, and the majority thought, was that it did give states kind of heightened regulatory powers that they would not otherwise have, including the power to pass laws that might violate other provisions of the Constitution, that it did kind of insulate some regulation from meaningful scrutiny. But also, I think part of their position was driven by a suspicion of the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. The Commerce Clause speaks, strictly speaking, it's a conferral of authority on the federal government to regulate interstate commerce. But the Supreme Court has long held, dating back to the 19th century, that there is an implication in the Commerce Clause that it also restricts states in their ability to pass laws that discriminate against interstate commerce. The very purpose of the clause was to ensure states could not engage in trade wars or discriminate against goods and services that were coming from other states. Justices Gorsuch and Thomas, I think, read the clause extremely literally and say, hey, it's only a conferral of authority on the federal government. It doesn't restrict the states in any meaningful way. But that's just not consistent with what we know about the history and the purpose of the clause. And thankfully, those seven justices in the majority recognized that, no, the clause does, in fact, impose meaningful restrictions on states and prohibits the kind of discrimination that Tennessee was engaged in.
And the outcome of this, of course, for our clients is that they're in business and they have their liquor shop in Memphis, and they're going to continue on, which is great. And talk a little bit about the implications for IJ's work and others moving forward with this precedent?
Sure. Well, as with any IJ victory, we don't just celebrate and then pack it in. We look to see how we can make something even bigger of it. And that's exactly what we're going to do in this case. That starts with going to those other states with similar durational residency requirements and ensuring that they repeal them in light of the Supreme Court's opinion. But it also means parlaying the court's decision into something bigger beyond the alcohol industry, first of all. Other Commerce Clause challenges to challenge laws that are motivated by protectionism, and perhaps even beyond the Commerce Clause scenario itself. If, after all, economic protectionism is not a permissible justification to regulate alcohol when the state has a very clear police power and where there are, you know, legitimate health and safety concerns, then surely it can't be a permissible justification to regulate in other areas where the state's police power is perhaps less clear or where there aren't real health and safety concerns. So we are absolutely looking at ways where we can parlay that, the court's holding about economic protectionism, into other areas. And again, as with everything IJ does, we don't just pack up and call it a day after we win. We're always looking to make it make this big victory, this huge victory, into something even bigger.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Michael. And let's turn to our litigation director, Dana, to talk about some other cases that the court decided this year that impact upon individual liberty. And we had a question that was pre-submitted to us from Jane in California that asked, what does the future of the regulatory state appear to be given the current composition of SCOTUS? And that kind of touches on some interesting decisions that the court handed down this term, impacting in particular administrative law and what many people call the administrative state. There's clearly interest on the part of many justices in that issue, and they had occasion, at least in a couple cases this term, to weigh in on that. So you could talk a little bit about that.
So there were two cases this term that were strange in that they didn't overturn any existing precedent, and yet at the same time, there was a lot of reason to think that the court might do so in the future. So one case was Kaiser versus Wilkie, which was about whether federal agencies interpret their own regulations all the time. And there is a doctrine that courts will defer to the agency's interpretation of their own regulations rather than the court deciding independently what the regulation means. And this is a long-standing kind of deference. It's one of the many, many ways that courts defer to government entities instead of to individuals. And what happened in the case was, in this one, they did not overrule this doctrine, but Justice Kagan wrote the decision. Justice Roberts joined it, but in a kind of, yeah, we should defer, but there are a million different restrictions on how we're going to defer, and we're going to narrow it, but we shouldn't explicitly say we're overruling it. Then at the same time, there was a four-justice dissent from Gorsuch, Thomas, Kavanaugh, saying, and Alito saying, okay, we cannot overrule it now, but
right,
we really think this should be overruled in the future. And it's clear that what's going on is we've got four justices that do not want to overrule this deference, four who definitely do, and Roberts is trying to figure out where he's going to be on this issue. But regardless, the way that they decided the case means there's less deference to agencies now, to federal agencies, than there was before in a bunch of different ways. So that's going to be very good for individual liberty because agencies like to interpret their regulations in whatever way suits their exercise of power best at the moment. And now maybe they can't do that so much anymore. The other case was called Gundy versus United States, and it had sort of a similar pattern. The decision was written by Kagan, and this was a case about whether Congress could delegate, in this case, to the Attorney General, its lawmaking power to decide what would happen with sex offender registration for people that committed their crimes before there was sex offender registration. And Congress, like it so often does, punted this decision to somebody else. So instead of putting it in the law and actually making a decision, they left it up to the Attorney General to figure out what to do. So they left it up to the prosecutor to decide what was criminal and what wasn't. That's not really a good plan. But what happened was they upheld it. Justice Alito, who was the deciding vote, concurred but said, you know what, I think we should overrule all of this delegation doctrine, but if we're not going to do that today, I don't want to make an exception for this one. I don't want to make an exception only for sex offenders. But I don't like this doctrine. And then the other three justices, Gorsuch, Roberts, and Thomas, said, we got to get rid of this doctrine altogether. No more delegating all of your legislative responsibilities to other agencies and officials. Kavanaugh was not a part of that case, so we don't know how he would vote, but he would end up being the fifth when that issue comes about. So we had strong hints that there are going to be some significant cutbacks on how much federal agencies can get away with without judicial review. And that's going to be very interesting in the future.
And that's key, because the key to that, too, is having then an engaged judiciary that will actually look at the actions both of administrative agencies and really any government agency. An idea, of course, that we are constantly pushing and that our cases are designed to elevate at all times. So, stay tuned for administrative state cases. Those are definitely ones that the court is going to, I think, really take up in the future. Let's talk just a little bit, too, about a case called Nick that our friends at the Pacific Legal Foundation litigated. And just talk a little bit about what that case was and what it meant.
So the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, nor shall private property be taken for just compensation without just compensation, means for that there are two guarantees. One is that property can only be taken for public use, and the other that just compensation must be paid when it is taken. And the rule for about 30 years has been that if you want compensation for your property and you haven't gotten it, you can't go to federal court. Instead, you had to go to state court, litigate all the way through state court that you were entitled to compensation, and then you could go to federal court if they didn't give you compensation, except, oops, the case had already been litigated in state court. Under full faith and credit, you couldn't bring it in federal court.
Classic catch-22.
Totally. So what this meant is that people were always stuck in state court, and of course, state courts don't want to make the state have to pay compensation. So this was a very bad system for property owners. And it had gotten so bad, in fact, that it really was bleeding out into cases that weren't about compensation at all, but just involved property. And federal courts were saying, maybe this sort of kind of has to do with takings, so we're not going to hear it. And that was, again, terrible development for property owners. In this case, Rosemary Nick had a small family graveyard on her property in Pennsylvania. The state had passed a law that all graveyards had to be open to the public during normal business hours. She did not want to open up her home and land to the public. And so she sued. And even though she wasn't asking for compensation, the federal court said, oh no, got to do that in state court, can't be in federal court. And that case then went up, and the Supreme Court actually overruled this entire doctrine, which was 30 years of precedent saying property owners can't go to federal court. So that's going to be great for property owners who have compensation issues, but it'll be great for all property owners because they were increasingly getting shunted out of federal court and unable to vindicate their federal rights in federal court like they're supposed to.
Great. Well, let's before we turn to questions that people submitted and any calls that we might have, to talk about a trend that we saw that several people have commented on and one that we actually find encouraging, and that is where Justice Gorsuch has been coming down in a lot of these cases. He has been exhibiting, I think it's fair to say, in several instances, this skepticism about government power and a willingness to hold government officials accountable. And we saw that in some of the cases we had already mentioned, despite him, we think, getting the 21st Amendment wrong in the Tennessee case. But we saw this in a number of cases we discussed, but also we saw him teaming up with some of the more liberal members of the court in some important criminal procedural cases as well. So could you talk a little bit about the one in particular that impacts a lot of our work, which is the vagueness doctrine and what happened in that case and why that's so encouraging?
Sure. That was in U.S. v. Davis, and it was written by Gorsuch, but joined the other four justices who joined it were the more left-wing justices. And this was a case holding that a federal statute was unconstitutionally vague because you couldn't quite tell what it meant by a crime of violence involving a firearm. But I think certainly it's good in a criminal context, but it's good way beyond that because it really emphasized that statutes have to be clear and people have to know when they're violating the law. In this case, they overturned a law that has been applied thousands of times, and yet they were willing to overturn it. And that tells us we can use that precedent all over the place because governments constantly write laws that are far too vague, where nobody understands what they're talking about, have no idea that they're violating the law. And this case really indicates that the court will be willing to put some limits on that.
Exactly. So we are going to stay, of course, extremely active at the court. We had that great victory in the Timms case on forfeiture and the excessiveness clause, but we want to get other forfeiture issues back up before the court to end this practice once and for all, to follow up on our economic protectionism work that we are constantly looking for cases to get that issue definitively resolved by the Supreme Court. And then we have our Montana decision, a case that we will hopefully get a favorable decision on in the Supreme Court's next term. So it's going to remain very active, and stay tuned.
Thank you, Scott. With that, we'd like to turn to questions from our listeners. We'll start taking live questions in just a moment. If you have a question for any of the attorneys on the call, just press star on your phone and you will be added to the queue. But before we turn to the live questions, let's start with a few that were submitted in advance. Jim from North Carolina wrote to say he would like a feel for what issues are most favorable to pursue at the Supreme Court right now.
I would say probably property rights and free speech. It looks like there's a good majority on both of those issues. I mean, I'd love to pursue more, of course, but property rights and free speech are looking good right now.
Michael from Colorado wrote to ask, is Kavanaugh any good?
Well, it's always hard to say about justices, especially when they've only been on the court for a limited period of time. I think that what we'll see happen, and this is, again, just a prediction that take with a grain of salt, is that he is not going to be as kind of skeptical, I think, as Justice Gorsuch has already displayed in questioning government's power of holding government officials strictly accountable to constitutional limits. But I think he does have a real orientation more toward individual rights and individual liberty than somebody like, for instance, Justice Alito, who's good on certain of our issues without question, but also was a former prosecutor. He oftentimes will rule on the side of the government in many instances for it. And so we'll have to see where Justice Kavanaugh ends up. And we'll continue to make our best case to him and all the justices and look for these non-traditional alliances, too, that we saw play out in some decisions on the Supreme Court. And hopefully we'll see more of in the future.
We have a question from Susan in Washington. Susan, you are live. What's your question?
My question is whether, with the new makeup of the Supreme Court, there's any likelihood that Kelo will be revisited.
Well, that's, I'll let Dana weigh in on that. Dana and I, of course, very close to this. And that is our ultimate goal, is to get the Kelo case reconsidered by the courts. A great question, and one that even Justice Scalia would consistently say in his public comments that he thought that Kelo was the most likely decision to be overturned by a future court. And so we are still pursuing those opportunities to get this issue back up before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has changed its composition pretty substantially since then. I think the one thing that might dissuade it, at least for now, is the fact that the backlash to Kelo was so intense and so many states changed their laws and developers and governmental interests became so concerned about abusing the power of eminent domain that a lot of the projects now that we would see routinely have sort of faded away. And while there's still certain states where it is abused, and we just won a case in New Jersey, as you might know, involving the Atlantic City's attempt to take Charlie Birnbaum's home, I think the fact that it doesn't happen nearly as much as it once did, certainly at the time that we did Kelo, the court might think it's not as pressing. But if these cases start coming back in full force, I think the time will be very ripe for the court to take up the issue. And we're confident that it will be overturned and consigned to its rightful place in the dustbin of history.
And in the meantime, we're trying to bring other eminent domain cases before the court that maybe involve due process and don't require them to go quite as far as overturning Kelo, but may hopefully warm them up to that idea.
Reminder, if you have a question, just press star on your phone and we'll add you to the queue. We have a question from Melissa in Georgia. Melissa, you are live. What's your question?
Sure. So it seems like the Timms victory opened up a lot of possibilities for you. How is IJ building on that decision?
Well, it's a great question and one that we are really pursuing on a number of different fronts. I think the court in Timms and certain statements made by Justice Thomas in previous decisions show that the court is really interested in the issue of civil forfeiture, like it is in administrative law issues. And we want to bring these other claims up to the Supreme Court on civil forfeiture involving how can the government be taking people, innocent people's property in the first instance, the profit incentive that underlies a lot of these laws. We want to get that issue up before the Supreme Court. But the great thing about the Timms decision is also given us ammunition in our work that we're doing, as I'm sure listeners know, in pursuing these abusive fines and fees schemes. The court in Timms said the excessive fines clause applies to state and local governments. It means something. There are limits on the fining power of the government. And so this gives us the ability to challenge these abusive fines and fees schemes. And that's becoming a major part of our property rights work. That's going to continue to grow. And we, through our strategic litigation, will look for opportunities to bring that issue up before the Supreme Court. Because that is an area that, as I said, is rife with abuse. And there's all different ways and angles of attacking that. And we're going to stay hard at that.
All right. And we have time for one last question. It's from Alan in New York. Alan, you are live. What's your question?
I'd like to know, the privileges immunity clause has been put into the dustbin of history, but it looks like Is there any hope that with the new constituted Supreme Court that it may come back to life?
We certainly have hope that at least a couple of justices are interested in doing so. We've long known that Justice Thomas is looking for the right opportunity to revisit the clause. He has said so dating back to the 1990s, and he is very interested in restoring it to its rightful place as the primary bulwark for economic liberty in our country. But we had a surprise this term in the Timms case, where Justice Gorsuch seemed to suggest that he is open to revisiting the meaning of the Privileges or Immunities Clause as well. Justice Gorsuch suggested that the proper way to incorporate protections of the Bill of Rights against the states is through the Privileges or Immunities Clause as opposed to the Due Process Clause. He went along with the Due Process approach in that case because that is the long-established approach that the court has followed. But he did say that, you know, he thought that perhaps privileges or immunities is the right way to go about incorporating those protections against the states. And that gives us a lot of hope that perhaps he, like Justice Thomas, is open to revisiting the clause and the Slaughterhouse cases, which was the 1873 decision that largely gutted the clause of its rightful place as, again, the primary bulwark of protecting economic liberty, but also other fundamental rights of American citizens.
And with that question, we're out of time for today. Thank you again to Scott and the rest of our participants for your insights. Thanks to everyone on the phone for joining the discussion. If you missed any part of this conversation, we will have links to an audio recording of the call available next week. That'll be on our website at ij.org/supreme-court/roundup. Call was a different one. If you have any questions or comments we weren't able to get to, just stay on the line. You can leave a voicemail for us or shoot me an email and we will get back to you. Thank you again for your support of IJ and have a great evening.